What are you doing up at this hour of the night?
What are you doing up at this hour of the night?
Prevention of crime. Every hour of the day and night.
Movie.
Break.
Is the team that protects your property and you.
Hello and welcome to the Movie Break podcast. We are here on the fourth day of the Sundance Film Festival. My name is Patrick and with me is Lida.
Hi.
Lida, how are you doing?
Yeah, I already told you guys that today I'm kind of pissed because yesterday I didn't get into a screening even though I did have a ticket and was there way on time. So this can happen at Sundance, and what I learned already both from staff and from other festival visitors is that it just doesn't happen once in a few years as in Cannes, where a similar scenario occurred a few years ago. I think it was Bird.
But it also happened with the Almodovar short film, right?
Oh, remember that? So, but with a short film, it's more understandable because usually hardly anybody watches short films. But here, it's just like a daily occurrence.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, every film has like 50 people or something, or 100 people who have a ticket turned away. And like every premiere film, every public premiere screening. And that is just something that's unacceptable for a major festival.
Yeah, perhaps let's just explain that to our listeners. So they basically overbook the screenings.
Exactly. Or let's say it's this way. There are certain batches that do not have to book tickets like Patrick and I have to. They can just walk into the theater. Now, a certain amount of seats for every screening is reserved for these so-called red badges, but if a lot of red badges show up, more than allocated seats, and the allocated seats are maybe like 150 or 200, so let's say 300 or 400 or 500 red badges show up, then just the same amount of people with tickets won't get into the screening because the red badges go in first.
Yeah, it is a crazy experience, and they even mention on the website that the purchase of a ticket does not mean that you will have a seat, actually. It says, yeah, you better be here 45 minutes early. But even if you have a ticket, that does not guarantee your seating there. So it's a crazy experience. I don't think I have any comparable festival in mind where they do the same thing. And in a way, the money rules the world here. Because if you have one of these premium badges, they basically come through money.
And either you're like working for a super important medium, something like Hollywood Reporter, mm-hmm, or Daily News or something, or you have a lot of money. And this is really like against everything that Sundance presents that they stand for, especially since it would be so easy to fix. You know, you could just make a system where the red badges have to book tickets but have priority booking, and then you would at least know that if you have a ticket as a green badge or as a normal visitor, you do get in. And otherwise, you can at least do something else with your time. You could watch something else. You don't lose your time. That's another thing, you know, you just lose like 2 or 3 hours with standing in the cold.
That is true. On the other hand, I want to say that I've been treated very well here because this time I'm on crutches here because I just had some surgery, and people here are very accommodating. So I'm grateful to that as well. I am always being seated while waiting in line, and I think that is much appreciated also for people who need it even more than I do, because for me it's more of a momentary situation. But in any case, I also read online, but you know, I have no way of verifying this, but I apparently Barry, the Moonlight director, Barry Jenkins. His wife, Lulu Wang, they were seen in the audience lining up, and they were, you know, pulled forward to the top of the line, so they didn't have to line up. So,
but I think this is kind of like, it would have been interesting if they, for example, would have refused to say like, no, we wait like everybody else, you know?
I think there were some people waiting in line that got a bit infuriated about that, but I think once they heard who they are, then they I don't know if one should agree with that or not, but that's how it goes here. That reminds me also that often when we are when we have been to Venice, for instance, there was Luca Guadagnino lining up among the
Vaporetto.
Other people.
Yeah, I also saw Laf Diaz lining up for the Vaporetto. So at the Venice Vaporetto line, at least there seems to be a certain sense of equality.
Right.
If the boat is full, the boat is full.
Well, let's maybe move to our movies for today. We have William Greaves' Once Upon a Time in Harlem, which I liked a lot. We have Josephine, the film that I already hinted at on our last episode. And Lida, you have seen I Want Your Sex Now as well, right?
Exactly, the new Greg Araki film. And yeah, Greg Araki, he's like a veteran of this festival. And of course, all his films, or most of his films, are a lot about sex, even if they're not so much necessarily about sex as this one. And it's a lot of weird comedy, offbeat, gross humor, all those trademark Greg Araki things. And of course, a lot of bright colors and weird interior designs, weird costumes, everything that we know about. And of course we see him. Greg Araki is in each one of his films, and here we also see him in a nice little cameo as a priest.
Oh, as a priest?
I think he's the priest,
ah, okay.
Right?
You know, I'm so bad at recognizing people. I thought he was the blonde, the guy with the blonde pink hair who is also like an intern or something at this agency.
No. I think he's way older. He already in that age he was like 20 years ago. So now he's in his 50s, and we see him as a priest who marries the. Or who appears to marry the main characters.
But to be fair, he has a very youthful face still. Okay, I have no idea what's happening here, but we are in a sort of lounge here, and a dog has entered, and this leads to some uproar.
The dog star, yeah. Maybe some animal actor.
And even being filmed here, so perhaps that's like the festival dog or something. In any case, let's perhaps give an overview over I Want Your Sex. So we have as the two leads, we have Olivia Wilde as a sort of dominatrix artist who basically leads a gallery, I think. And we have Cooper Hoffman, who starts as an intern there. And the chronology of the events here is a bit confused. By choice, of course, we start basically at the end, and then we see how this has all come to place. We see Cooper Hoffman with a bloody face, and we see what appears to be a body floating in a swimming pool of a large mansion. Lida, what can we say about this film?
Well, it's typically like crazy, weird satire, but in-your-face satire that deliberately like tries to slaughter certain holy cows of the American society and go against these typically prudish ideas of mainstream U.S. TV and cinema. So Greg Araki is very good in it, but also because he did it a very long time, it's not really as fresh as it probably should feel.
Yeah, it's true. I think he tried to make this film for 10 years or so. I also felt like it felt a bit dated in a way. It didn't feel like the year 2026. But I liked how it is very threadbare, right? We have all these sets that really seem like sets. And as you said earlier, the set decoration is really well done. The Cooper Hoffman character, I forgot his name, but he's in this apartment that has it's incredibly colorful throughout, and there are a lot of Easter eggs and little hints at other movies or just, I guess, the influential artists for Greg Araki as well. I think for the most time Cooper Hoffman wears this Sonic Youth shirt, for instance, and yeah, so he shows up in this art gallery and cannot believe that he's being hired actually for not much of a salary, but I guess the intrigue here is that he falls for the Olivia Wilde character, of whom Greg Araki on stage said that this is to him one of the biggest movie stars, and he reminds him of movie stars of earlier eras. So, and in that sense, she's sort of positioned in this movie, right?
Absolutely. And she really delights in playing this kind of domina role and having all kinds of kinky, funny sex. That's always a little bit surreal. So that's also another thing, that Greg Araki always has this provocative sex idea. But other than in his really older films, also films like The Living End that dealt with HIV and stuff like that, it's never real sex. It's always just cartoon sex.
Yeah.
So you're provoked, but never really provoked. So if you would have some mainstream, like some independent drama with full front nudity, this would be so much more than all these sex scenes.
Yeah, and I was very confused in that regard, because as he entered the stage, he described that the shoot was very precarious in a way, and very makeshift at times, and that they had to start with the hardcore sex scenes. And then I watched the movie and I wondered
hardcore sex scenes. So I wonder, does Greg Araki know what a hardcore sex scene is?
I wonder too. But what I do find interesting, and I think the film did that well, is it conflated the idea of desire with AI. So there's certain animations here, like, I don't know, breasts popping out that are done what appears to be AI. And this idea how our desires basically these days shaped also through the AI lens as well, I think that added something more contemporary to this film that overall feels a bit dated.
Yeah, and there's also this cartoonish element, and I like slightly psychedelic element when he sees, for example, the main character sees stickers coming to life and speaking to him and stuff like that, like motivational quotes that directly approach him. So this is a nice little touch.
Yeah, and overall I just liked how free the entire structure was, how it could permanently reinvent itself if it wanted to, when in the final act there's more something of a con game being played as well, and all these scenes play out more like episodes. I think has a very episodic structure that sometimes feel more like TV in a way, but not necessarily in a bad way, just as a way that, you know, it doesn't look quite like as cinema in a conventional sense. And I had a good time with this film. It's not great. I don't think it's, you know, it is on par with some of the classics which I think he has produced in the past, in the 90s or early 2000s as well, still, right? Yeah, but I would recommend this film.
Yeah, sure. I have more sympathy for Greg Araki than I do like his films, so I don't enjoy watching them so much, but I still appreciate what he does. And it's interestingly also one of three films at the festival where Charlie XCX appears in a smaller role.
That's true, yeah. She's the permanently bored
disinterested girlfriend, yeah.
Yeah, of Cooper Hoffman. Yeah, so that is that. Greg Araki's I Want Your Sex, I'm sure that will come out at some point. I don't know if that is more of a streaming film or if this will actually hit theaters. We're going to have to wait for that. Do you want to lead us to Once Upon a Time in Harlem, perhaps? Because I saw that you were also quite enamored by this. I saw you gave it a good rating, and I was happy about that, because to me that's still the best film I've seen here so far.
It's definitely one of the most important and one of the best films, especially in the documentary slide, because it's like a window into the time of the Harlem Renaissance at a later point in the Renaissance era. It started, I think, like in the 40s or 30s and then went on until the 70s.
No, I think it was earlier. It was much earlier. It was 1910s and 1920s.
Oh, even
it was,
so early.
After the Great Migration, when many people from the South, because Civil War and everything, right? When all the Black Americans moved toward the North to, you know, have careers and so on, and just escaping this kind of environment of slavery and so on. But yeah, the Harlem Renaissance was primarily in the 10s and 20s and even still 30s. But yeah, this is then Once Upon a Time, right? Like, they look back all these luminaries in the 1970s. I think they meet in 74?
Yeah, I think the Villa of Duke Ellington.
I think 72, right?
Yeah. And there's like this big party where a lot of those iconic figures of the Harlem Renaissance gather. Like, we have politicians and activists and painters and writers, poets,
yeah,
musicians, like, you name it. And they all just, like, discuss really deep themes and issues that still ring true today and still have a connection today. So you don't see the Harlem Renaissance as kind of like a bubble in time, but you really can see how it spreads into today's art world and how it continues to influence people, and how many of these questions are never solved. For example, this kind of issue, if complete equality is even possible, or if integration like leads to loss of identity, like these questions... That is still very, very timely, especially in a new era of discrimination. So that discrimination often moves in waves. It goes down a little and then it rises again.
Yeah. And William Greaves, the director, is a very interesting person. His work was sort of rediscovered, among others, through the help of Steven Soderbergh, because he had this... Greaves had this film, Symbiopsychotaxoplasm, that became a cult classic. I think it was rediscovered in the late 90s, but was actually shot in the 60s or so. And we have something similar going on here, where the first time we see this footage that was shot 50 years ago-ish, we already see it remastered, right? Like, we never had to go through this... process of first seeing the film decades ago and now seeing a newer version of it. This is, as you said, a capsule in time. And he struggled throughout his life making this film. He did make another short documentary for public television in the United States on the Harlem Renaissance, which was much more informational. This here is as much as it is that, it's also a meta conversation, right? About what is this? Is this a movement? Is this an awakening? What is the Harlem Renaissance? And the idea that all these people cannot really find a consensus on this. This is, I think, for me, one of the most intriguing aspects of the film.
Yeah, absolutely, because it also says so much about what actually makes this movement so poignant, that it has so many facets and that everybody can find something in it, and that it's not just the one specific thing. And of course, this continuous issue that people do not agree about where a movement ends and where it starts and what it's often, there are these things that feel so specific, and then it's actually very hard to explain what makes them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just to wrap it up, I think this film was also... parts of the footage were already shown at the Met in New York and at the MoMA, and it took some time. I think the late wife of William Greaves, she tried for quite some time to pull this thing together. And
he died in 2014.
Exactly, yeah. So it was now the son is credited as the co-director, and they all, with their own production company, they finished the film. And I think it's quite remarkable. I don't know if I would go as far. You know, there's Adam... No, not Adam. I always want to say Adam. The film critic from The New Yorker, Brody. That's not Adam Brody. What's his name? In any case, very influential critic. He said if that film had come out at the time, it would have changed history. I don't believe that at all, because I don't think cinema was even then as influential and powerful, and I don't think that so many people would have seen that film and changed their mind about how important the Harlem Renaissance is for...
I think that many black people would have seen it, but they, of course, already knew. So,
yeah.
And it's a film that's especially educative to white people.
Yeah, yeah. Even though there is some disappointment in the documentary as well, where some of the people interviewed, they argue that... their offspring, you know, the younger generations, that they are not so much, you know, that they are not so knowledgeable about this movement anymore. So there's even within that, there is some tension. But I think that adds just to the complexity of the film. And yeah, maybe we leave it at that.
Yeah, so we both absolutely love that. It's a very important document. It's fantastic quality. The remastering looks amazing.
Yeah.
It's very lively. You just get sucked into the conversation. So it's absolutely recommendation.
Mm-hmm. And you saw the new film with Olivia Colman.
Yeah, and Peter Dinklage. So The Wicker, that has this premise that we are like in a fictional medieval, late medieval time, or like something like the 17th century, but completely fairy tale-like in the sense that magic things happen and they're simply taken for granted. Just like in Red Riding Hood, the wolf talks and nobody questions that. And in this film, it's not a wolf that talks, it's a wicker man. And yeah, shunned, not very attractive, somewhat elderly fisherwoman played by Olivia Colman, who lives as a spinster, as the others in the village call her. So this word for a woman who is not married. Yeah, there's no male equivalent, but as a woman, if you do not marry by time, you become a spinster. And she wishes for a husband that she asks a basket weaver, played by Peter Dinklage, to weave for her. And then we actually see this very lifelike, perfect makeup, fantastic animatronics and everything, husband, like a man made from wicker, who then waits for her at the church, and the two marry, and the two have a very touching, loving relationship. And the film is actually not so much about this fantasy concept that she has a man that basically isn't human flesh, but that his kindness and his genuine love for her has so much influence on the rather mundane, practical, and very patriarchal relationships of the other women and men in the village. Because the women start to see what a relationship actually can be like, and the men feel inferior to this guy who has a great relationship with his wife's wife and fantastic sex life and has everything, while they have very complicated relationships with their wives. And yeah, the film is very mainstream, but there's a nice idea in it that love is not something that's granted, but something that's work.
Mm-hmm.
And that needs both people to do something, and it's continuous work, and you always have to give a little bit to get a little bit, and it can spark from loneliness, it can spark from desire, it can just spark from a coincidence or mutual interest, but you have to develop love. It's not just given.
And does that play out like an allegorical fairy tale, or how is that?
Yeah, in many aspects, because there's also like a lot of jealousy and conflicts that are kind of projected on this fisherwoman and her wicker man, so they become the target of much gossip and aggression, and there are really a few heartbreaking scenes, and there are even more wicker people coming up. So I can just tease on a little that we see also a wicker baby and a wicker woman, who are both very different than the wicker man. So it's quite a nice film. As I said, it's mainstream, it's very glossy, it's fantastically acted, great sets, but yeah, all in a mainstream way.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about if there's anything comparable. Is this a bit of a Pinocchio story in a way?
A little bit, I think, yeah.
Maybe.
It's based on a short story by a contemporary writer, so it kind of has elements of Pinocchio, just that Pinocchio is a very moralistic tale. Because this idea is like, why does Pinocchio, if he feels everything that a human being feels, why does he have to become a human being physically? Isn't he already one? And this is an interesting idea that the wicker man pursues, that he says, it doesn't matter what you're made of, your feelings are what make you human. And Pinocchio is actually a lot of about be a good kid, go to school, be obey to your parents, and all that stuff. And that's not very, very timely anymore.
Right. But yeah, that makes me then think of how some people treat AI these days, and that I find very dangerous, you know, when people ascribe emotions and so on to the machine. That is also a disturbing thought. So yeah, does it play into that as well? Like, does that discuss?
Not really, because it's more magic.
Okay.
And and the allegory is more like, and they use a lot of allegorism in the typical fairy tale and fable sense. And there's of course this idea that people have to work on the same thing, they have to have shared interests, and that different ideas of a balance, that some people think that a balance is if they are in power, if they are in charge, and other people perceive that a balance is really equality. So yeah, a lot of nice little timely ideas, and it just looks amazing, and it's a great cast. Also Elizabeth Debicki is in it, in a supporting role, so very well done.
And in the old Roger Ebert style, thumbs up or thumbs down for this one?
Definitely thumbs up. Okay. But again, it's a mainstream film, so it's not as deep as it could be, but it's entertaining, it's nice, and one of, I think, two films with Peter Dinklage in it.
Yeah, I saw the Shitheads. Yeah, okay. And I think I will end it on Josephine, a film I'm sure you will then perhaps discuss with Jakob when the Berlinale hits later this... Is it next month, right?
Next month, thankfully.
And Josephine is a film by Beth de Arauja. I don't know how to correctly pronounce her name, but this is her second film after Soft and Quiet. Did you see that film?
Oh, yeah, I did. And I thought it was very interesting. I liked it, even though it wasn't perfect, but I really liked this concept on those ultra-conservative fascist women.
I heard very confusing things about this film. Like, it has... Like, it's the fight against Nazis or something? And
yeah, it focuses on a group of women that are all extreme right-wing conservatives. And they're each a different type of conservative. So there's this, like, old-school Nazi white supremacist. There's, like, the young, frustrated underclass person who says, like, oh, I don't hate anybody. And then, of course, she does. And they then turn their violence against two young Asian women.
I see. Yeah, I have to catch up with that. I will say Josephine seems to be in a different register just in terms of, you know, how out there it is. This is much more intimate, I think, as far as I can tell, not having seen the other one. Much more of a classic drama in a sense that is perhaps comparable to films like The Hunt, you know, with Mads Mikkelsen, in the sense that there is a central event and people have to deal with this kind of event. And I think I can reveal this because it's the basic premise of the film. It's that the 8-year-old eponymous Josephine, she sees something at the beginning of the film. She sees some act of violence, and the rest of the film basically unfolds in a way that has her come to wrestle with the events she has seen, how she can make sense of it, how she has to perhaps talk or not talk about this. And she has two parents who are played by Channing Tatum and Gemma Chan, and they are also somewhat helpless because there's only so much they can do for her. There's something she has to do there herself. She has to understand how vulnerable she can be in that sense, because there's later the court where she is when you're called into court to give your
statement
as a witness, she has to do that. And you can imagine as an 8-year-old that comes with a lot of challenges, especially if you are still sort of traumatized by what you have seen. And on a formal basis, it starts a bit like Nickel Boys, when we see everything from her perspective. It changes, but it comes back to that perspective recurringly, and it's well done. I think I would like to have seen this made by perhaps a European director, not so much an American, because I think often it overstays its welcome. It's often people talk too much in this film, I think, in a way that is not therapeutic, but it's explaining what's going on, what we see in this certain moment. And I think the film is strongest when it just leaves us with the with the visceral reactions of her. How does Josephine react to a new environment? How does she talk to the people of the law enforcement or the court? And I think it's often strongest when it's just in these interstitial spaces rather than in the scenes that are that basically play to the actor's strengths. That being said, I think Channing Tatum and Gemma Chan and the Josephine actor, I will quickly look up her name if I can. Her name is Mason Reeves. So perhaps she has a career in front of her as well now. I think it plays to their abilities. It's very much indebted to their acting that the film works the way it works, and it has strong scenes. Sometimes I think there are scenes that the film itself would work better without these scenes, but one is still glad to have these scenes just to see the acting unfold on screen. So overall, I think that's a strong film here in the lineup, in the Sundance lineup. I just wish it had at times been a bit more subtle. Yeah. So far, that's what I can say. And yeah, I think that brings us to the end of this episode.
Yeah, maybe I can just very quickly mention The Gallerist, because The Gallerist had so many themes that overlap with Greg Araki's I Want Your Sex. We have Natalie Portman in a weird offbeat comedy on the modern art world as a gallerist who's confronted with a very arrogant influencer who then, literally slips up and gets impaled on a modern work of art. And then they just pretend that this is the artwork in the sense of Damien Hirst, you know, bodies in silicone. And this satire, I say a lot of star power, Natalie Portman, Jenna Ortega, Daniel Brühl shows up, but it was never as funny as it wanted to be, and it was just so curious to see all those similarities to I Want Your Sex pop up. Like the modern artwork, there's even a sentence that's almost exactly the same when somebody says potato, potato, and in both films this appears in one scene that this is very similar. So yeah, it's kind of just funny if you discover that on festivals that films have these
right
parallels.
But does it take the artwork itself more seriously in a way that it is portrayed more realistically? Because I remember reading that it takes place at the Art Basel in Miami, right?
Exactly. So that was a thing that I appreciated, and it was interesting that we see a lot of artworks in this film in the background that are actual artworks,
mm-hmm.
or copies of actual artworks. And so this film does not completely go into this reactionary vein that says, oh, contemporary art, it's just ridiculous. Patching a banana at a wall, I can do that. You know, just typically things. And of course, there's a lot of reference to modern art. Like, we hear about the self-destructing Banksy and all these things. So I think it has a certain basic respect for contemporary art, but in the end of the day, it's still, I think, there's this one scene where we just are confronted with a slideshow of classical painting. And I think in the idea of the audience that this film caters to, and in the mind of the director, it's like classical art is up there, and somewhere lower comes contemporary art, and it's just not as good. And I strongly disagree. I think contemporary art can be as good as Ingres. I even think that painters like Ingres and Delacroix are completely overvalued. They're not as great. They're just like more technicians than original painters. Like, they study a lot and then they paint a perfect sky, but it's never original. But yeah, that's definitely a little bit of condescension for contemporary art in there.
I mean, the notion of modernism and contemporariness is so interesting because, of course, there's always a new modernism, right? Like, today's what is considered to be modern will be different from 20 years from now. And then many of the artworks that are now, the discussed works will disappear and vanish because they will not get canonized. And we can only know in retrospect later what were the actual great works of the time. So
yeah, and there's often this misunderstanding about art, like what is modern art and what is contemporary art. So modern art, that's like mid to late 19th century. Andy Warhol or even Picasso is a modern artist, even though he's been dead for like decades. And contemporary art, that's like Banksy or Yayoi Kusama. The people who are still alive and producing, they're contemporary artists.
Okay. Yeah, I think I understand that a bit differently, but that's basically because I attended this class on Frederick Jameson, and he distinguishes between modernist and modern. So he says the modern is that which, you know, ever defines itself anew, you know, it brings always something new about, whereas the modernist was this period,
okay,
as you mentioned.
Then,
in that.
Yeah, he makes it more specific.
Yeah. But in any case, good to hear. I will see that film tonight, so perhaps I can report on my experience with that film as well. In the meantime, what can we talk about next time? I think I will shout out the John Wilson documentary here. Now, many people know How to with John Wilson, the HBO show, and so this is his debut documentary film. And I might talk about The Invite, which you will see later.
Yeah, but that's fine. Yeah, that's completely okay for me. I might talk a little bit about Gail Dougherty and the celebrity sex pest, depending on how good it is. And, well, tomorrow then, I haven't seen it yet, but I have still the Brittany Griner story. Like, it's one of the documentaries that I'm most looking forward to about Brittany Griner and her incarceration in Russia. And The Weight, it's also like a heavy drama by Patrick McKinley with a more or less stellar cast that I'm very, like Ethan Hawke, Russell Crowe, Julia Jones, so I'm also very curious for that one, but that's still the day after tomorrow, so.
Okay, then thank you, Lida, for today, and see you soon.
Yeah, bye-bye.